From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with filmmaker Noah Baumbach. His Oscar-nominated feature, The Squid and the Whale, is out now on DVD. It's a portrait of a family torn apart by divorce and stars Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney. Also, actor Macaulay Culkin has just written a new book. The film Home Alone made him a star. By the age of 8, he was already being hounded by the paparazzi. His most recent films are Party Monster and Saved. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews L'Enfant, a new feature from Belgium. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Squid and the Whale, the latest film by writer-director Noah Baumbach, has just come out on DVD. He's our first guest today. Terry spoke with him last fall when The Squid and the Whale opened in theaters. Prior to that film, Noah Baumbach wrote and directed the movies Kicking and Screaming and Mr. Jealousy, and co-wrote the screenplay for The Life Aquatic, directed by Wes Anderson. His next film is another collaboration with Anderson on a stop animation version of The Fantastic Mr. Fox, based on the story by Roald Dahl. The Squid and the Whale is based loosely on Noah Baumbach's childhood experiences when his parents divorced. His father is the writer Jonathan Baumbach, his mother, the film critic Georgia Brown. The Squid and the Whale stars Jeff Daniels as Bernard, a pretentious, self-absorbed English professor and author who is starting to feel a bit overshadowed by his wife's new writing career. It's the wife, Joan, played by Laura Linney, who has decided the marriage is over. Bernard is miserable about this, and so are the two children, 16-year-old Walt and 12-year-old Frank. The film is set in the 1980s in the Park Slope neighborhood of Brooklyn, where Baumbach grew up. In this scene, the parents gather the kids for a family meeting.
Okay. Your mom and I... Okay, yeah. Mom and I are going... We're going to separate.
You're not going to be leaving either of us.
We're going to have joint custody. Frank, it's okay. I've got an elegant new house across the park.
Across the park? Is that even Brooklyn?
It's only 5 stops on the subway. It's an elegant block, the filet of the neighborhood. We'll have a ping pong table.
I don't play ping pong.
And we'll both see you equally.
How will that work?
We're splitting up the week, alternating days.
Why?
Because I love you and I want to see you as much as your mother does.
But there's 7 days.
Right.
So how will you split evenly with 7 days?
Oh, I've got you Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, and every other Thursday.
Every other?
That's how we each have you equally.
That was your father's idea.
Don't do this.
How will I get to school?
There's a subway 4 blocks from the house. 4 or 5. No more than 6 blocks.
And what about the cat?
Cat.
We didn't discuss the cat.
Your father will pick him up on those days when you're switching houses.
I'll have to drive here 2 additional times a week.
You got a place on the other side of the park. If you'd gotten a place near here, it wouldn't be a problem.
This neighborhood's gotten very expensive. Joan, it's very painful for me to stay in this neighborhood. You know that. Don't be difficult. I feel banished.
Oh, pickle.
So, Dad, what will happen with the cat?
We'll figure something out.
Noah Baumbach, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your movie, the parents divorce, and they want to do joint custody. And joint custody always seems like such a kind of civil, reasonable thing to do instead of fighting over custody. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the kids really don't like this idea at all because they're going to be having to go, you know, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays to one house and Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to another. And So I guess it was easy for you to see it from the kids' point of view because that's the point of view you saw the divorce from when your parents separated. Did they do joint custody with you?
They did, and that's actually my actual joint custody arrangement in the movie was the one we had. They were, as you said, they were very reasonable, rational people. They had it all figured out. And I think probably until I actually wrote it down, I didn't realize how bizarre it was.
So how did it work for you going back and forth?
I was a teenager, and I, you know, sort of also at a point in my life where, in some ways having a separate life from your parents is starting to become important to you. It's part of your own sort of sense of self and identification. So to be sort of, you know, trapped in this arrangement where I couldn't, you didn't have the power to break a night, you know, if it was more convenient for me to, I was nearer to my mother's and wanted to go there, I still had to go to my dad's. And it became, it was so incredibly rigid. So I hated it. You know, I think I was often told at the time, you know, that I had, it was actually more, you know, deeper, more painful feelings that I was probably, sort of sublimating with more this sense of annoyance, you know, in the joint custody arrangement. But in, you know, I think part of the thing I realized when I wrote the script is that actually these little irritations weren't so little. This was a big deal. It was a huge imposition, you know, on the kids. And, you know, so you know, it's something in a way I even became more attuned to as I wrote the script and then made the movie.
You grew up in a house where, you know, your parents were writers. They were intellectuals. The film is filled with the kind of problems a child would face growing up in a home like that. For example, the difficulty of developing your own opinions when your parents' opinions are so strong, particularly about the arts. For example, in the movie, the father will say, when talking about F. Scott Fitzgerald, "Oh, Tender is the Night, that's minor Fitzgerald." And so if anybody asks the teenage son if he's read Tender is the Night, he'll just shrug his shoulders dismissively and say, "Oh, that's minor Fitzgerald." But of course, he's never read Fitzgerald, and he has no real opinion of his own of Fitzgerald, but he knows what he's supposed to think based on what his father thinks. And it's obviously going to be very hard for him to develop a sense of intellectual independence. And that's the kind of issue I think that's not really brought up a whole lot in movies. You know, developing intellectual independence when you're around strong intellectual parents. Can you talk a little bit about trying to address that in the movie?
Well, I think it is interesting, and I've found it in my life, you know, my own life, but also people I know who come from similar backgrounds. The sort of idea of opinion as definition, in a way, you know, that you kind of define yourself by what you like, you know. And so if lots of people like one thing, you know, it becomes harder to define yourself that way, because it's like, well, if everybody likes Titanic, you know, I can't be the guy who likes Titanic, you know. So you need to then pick the thing that fewer people like, you know, the thing that fewer people have seen, in a way. And so it becomes a way for you to be defined by this work of art, you know, whether it's a book or a movie or, you know, music. And I, you know, I think you're right. I think on one hand, I think growing up among intellectuals and people who are, you know, interested and sophisticated about art can be terrific. I think it's great for kids to be introduced to all these things. But I think there is that danger where you suddenly are skipping so far ahead. You know, I mean, as a kid, I used to like dismiss, you know, Kurt Vonnegut and Tom Robbins and Jack Kerouac, you know, as sort of adolescent, you know, you know, meanwhile, I was an adolescent.
Right.
And so I was sort of jumping ahead to books that were more sophisticated, and in a lot of cases too sophisticated for me to even read. So it kind of left me in some ways paralyzed. And that's something I really, you know, went into with Walt in this movie, is that exact problem.
Jeff Daniels as the father, I think, does a really terrific job. Did you give him any advice about how to play this character?
Yeah. Jeff and I had I had a great experience with Jeff. Jeff has these kind of great sad blue eyes, and I sort of imagined, you know, if we gave him a beard sort of surrounding those eyes, it could be kind of incredible. So I told him to grow a beard, and you know, and I've been telling people I feel like the beard he grew in a way symbolizes his commitment to this character, because when he showed up, his beard was so huge and his hair was so long, it was almost, you know, out of Grizzly Man or something, and he we had to trim it back you know, I have a lot of sympathy for that character, and it's interesting because it's a character that really polarizes people. I mean, a lot of people see the movie and they're like, "Oh, the father's a bad guy. What a bad father!" And then other people really, you know, care for him and recognize his struggles and how hard it is for him. I mean, I had a Q&A in Toronto where I ended up sort of putting together this some strange sentence telling someone that unsympathetic people need our sympathy more than sympathetic people. And I was like, not exactly sure what I was saying, but I knew it meant something. But I talked to Jeff a lot about all the various sort of walls and boundaries that Bernard puts up around himself. I mean, all the sort of the talking that in a way is smokescreen. It's, you know, it's the, you know, whatever, like animal spray to kind of keep you away from them. I think Bernard is so vulnerable on some level, but he's created such a thick barrier around himself that I think he's afraid that any chink in it is going to just take him down entirely. And I think this is largely unconscious, by the way. I don't think Bernard is aware of this. But I think Bernard's ideas of success and, you know, failure are so out of whack with any kind of real success. I mean, I've seen people write about Bernard and refer to him as a failed novelist. And, you know, it's true that in the movie he doesn't have an agent and he's, you know, clearly things have been better for him, but he's still doing okay. It's not like he's, you know, in a way I feel like when they write that they're taking Bernard on his own terms. And so I talked to Jeff a lot about that. I also think that Bernard makes, and this is again unconscious, but he makes people feel sorry for him. You know, I think part of the reason it's really hard to confront him, particularly for his kids, is I think that there's always something there that makes you want to protect him. And I think Joan, in a way, had to become ruthless to get away from him, you know, I mean, to break up with him. And that's what Walt is reacting to. He's very angry at his mother for, from his perspective, you know, being so mean to his father and, you know, rejecting him. But I think in some ways Bernard makes it impossible to sort of rationally separate from him or to even just take a break. I think he so makes you feel like you need to be there for him. And it's a very strange thing because it's, on one hand, I think he makes you feel like you need to take care of him. And on the other hand, he wants you to idolize him.
Noah Baumbach speaking to Terry Gross last fall. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2005 interview with screenwriter and director Noah Baumbach. They're discussing his latest film, The Squid and the Whale. It's just been released on DVD.
You know, we've been talking about the father in the story, but the mother, as you've written her, is very interesting. You know, she is not as self-involved as the father is and doesn't seem to have as big and complex an ego. At the same time, she's apparently very talented. She has a book that's published during the course of the movie, and her career might actually be overtaking her husband's. Mm-hmm. And she also, you know, she's having affairs, and the boys find out about this. And so there's times when you are really with her emotionally watching this movie, and other times when you feel like, oh, she shouldn't be doing this. You know, and it's, you know, it's not good for her sons. Did you find yourself on her side or ambivalent about her?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, you know, on one hand, I did not want to judge either parent at any point, but I do think her character reveals itself, you know, in a different way than Bernard's does. I mean, Bernard in some ways is revealing himself or trying to reveal himself or actually trying not to reveal himself at every moment, but he's very present. And we in some ways learn a lot about what Joan has done or, you know, has said off camera as the movie goes. And I think partly because, you know, she's, you know, her intentions, you know, or her motivation in some ways is, you know, a mystery to these kids. I think, you know, what I like about the movie is that I think at any point that you can start to feel like, oh, this guy, I'm behind this person. I'm behind, oh, I get, you know, you identify with people. I mean, that's what it's about to some degree. Oh, I identify with them. And then suddenly they do something where you're like, oh God, you know, I don't, you know, that behavior was unexpected in some way, but you know, hopefully it's part of, you know, the whole package. And also in some ways, it's also more identifiable because we all act, you know, in complicated, bad and good ways all the time.
Writers and critics, like your parents or the parents in the movie, tend to really value honesty when it comes to their writing. And sometimes that requires almost a brutal honesty in which you might feel like you are betraying somebody that you love, but to capture the reality of the scene or your genuine reaction to the movie or to the book, you have to be honest, and that's part of your job. But writers who subscribe to that ethic of honesty don't necessarily enjoy being written about honestly themselves.
No, it's true.
How did your writer parents react to the portrayal of parents in your movie. Now, I mean, you are not writing about your parents. The movie is fiction, but we will all assume that to some extent it's based on the reality of your life. So what was it like for them to watch these portrayals? These not always flattering portrayals.
Well, I do think it's affectionate at the same time that, you know, certainly it's critical. And both my parents are fiction writers, so, and they've both written about their parents in fictional ways. So, you know, I think, you know, as best as you can in a situation like this, I really think they see it as a movie. And I could tell, like, you know, by their faces afterward, I mean, they really, you know, enjoyed, you know, being there. And I think they're also proud of me, you know, and excited for me, you know. And I think now they could see it, you know, the first time they saw it, I'm sure there was like this sort of, you know, like you're watching a movie with your foot on the brakes, you know, like of like, what, you know, what's going to happen here. But I think seeing it a second time, at least they, you know, they knew what to expect to some degree, and were able to kind of, you know, let go a little more. You know, but that said, I'm sure it's weird. but it is, it's a funny thing, because I do believe that if I hadn't fictionalized the movie as effectively as I have, it wouldn't feel as real as it does. And a lot of people have a very kind of raw experience watching the movie, which I love. I want that to be, I want that to be what the experience is. But, you know, for me, and I think subsequently for them now at this point, the movie is almost protective. It's not raw. It's another thing. It's a movie.
You have written and directed your movies, but there's one movie that you wrote that you didn't direct that was directed by Wes Anderson, and that's The Life Aquatic, mm-hmm. with Steve Zissou, which starred Bill Murray and Owen Wilson. And Wes Anderson produced this new movie that you wrote and directed. How did you end up in a partnership with him?
Well, our sort of professional relationship came out of our friendship, which had started in sort of the late 90s. I think we'd both initially had started hearing about each other because our first two movies, or his first movie and my first movie, Bottle Rocket being his and Kicking and Screaming being mine, came out around the same time. It was around 1995, and both underperformed brilliantly at the box office, and but they often both had very committed fans. Those who had seen it were very committed about them, and so we both heard a lot about each other. So when we met, we sort of, in some ways, felt, I think, some kind of kinship, and we became really great friends. And it's a funny thing sometimes to be asked about our professional relationship, like how does Wes influence you, and what have you gotten from Wes, and that's what's so enjoyable to me about it. I mean, both his work as a producer on this movie and my work as a co-writer on The Life Aquatic, it feels so much like an extension of our friendship, and so it's a nice thing.
The actor who plays the 12-year-old son in your movie has to say a lot of dirty language, bad words. And did his parents object at all to having to say that stuff in the movie?
Well, it's funny because his parents are actually friends of ours. His parents are the actors, Kevin Kline and Phoebe Cates. And my wife is Jennifer Jason Leigh, and she and Phoebe have known each other since Fast Times. So we often would have Sunday dinner. I mean, they're like family in a way. And I had, at the time, had been auditioning all these kids, and as you point out, it's a difficult role, and it's also a difficult role to audition people for, because you don't want to turn them off of their parents off of it too fast, and I was having a lot of trouble. I mean, it was a very, you know, I mean, it's one of those parts that if you don't get it exactly right, it's trouble. And Jennifer kept saying to me, you need someone like Owen. You know, Owen has this kind of just this genuine openness, but he's so bright, and he's, you know, there's something just so very natural and soulful about him. It was one of those things that one evening at dinner, I just got the guts to ask. And they had already read the script because they were friends and I'd shown it to them. And so they knew what they were getting into. And, you know, I think it's sort of not unlike, you know, you're asking me about what my parents think and I say they're writers. I mean, I think in this case, they're actors. You know, they know, you know, they know all the fakery of it. And again, Owen is such a sane kind of amazing kid, and his relationship with his parents is so you know, close and wonderful that, you know, saying those bad words and things, it wasn't like, you know, he was prepared for it. He knew them. He knew he was acting. It wasn't like, you know, there was any danger of him, you know, running around town saying those things.
Well, I could see this really awkward situation develop where he'd say that at the dinner table or something, and his parents would have to say, you can't talk that way at the dinner table. You can only talk that way in the movies.
Right, right. It's a very rarefied conversation.
Noah Baumbach, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Noah Baumbach speaking to Terry Gross last year. His latest film, The Squid and the Whale, has just been released on DVD. It stars Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo, introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Life After Home Alone. We'll talk with actor Macaulay Culkin. He became famous at age 8 and was a millionaire by age 10. He's just written a book called Junior. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews a new Belgian film called L'Enfant. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Former child actor Macaulay Culkin, star of the Home Alone movie series, has spent the last few years reinventing himself on film. In the fact-based movie Party Monster, he starred as a flamboyant, ultimately homicidal New York club kid. In Saved, he played a wheelchair-bound high school student. And in this continuing exercise in personal redefinition, Macaulay Culkin has just written a book. It's called Junior, and is described by the publisher as part fictional memoir, part rant, and part postmodern gamesmanship. Macaulay Culkin's most recent movie, the comedy Saved, is set in a Christian high school named American Eagle. It was produced by Michael Stipe's company, Single Cell. The story revolves around the girls in the school's Christian rock band. Jenna Malone plays a girl who tries to save her boyfriend's soul by helping him prove he's not really gay. Unfortunately, in the process, she becomes pregnant. Mandy Moore plays the school's most preachy Christian, and Macaulay Culkin plays her skeptical brother. As a result of a childhood accident, he needs a wheelchair to get around. He becomes close with the school rebel, who is also the school's only Jewish student, played by Eva Amuri. In this scene, Culkin and Amuri are talking at an outdoor cafe just across the street from the Planned Parenthood office.
What's the matter? I'm scared to be seen in public with a stripper.
No, I'm scared of being seen with a cripple.
I've been seen with worse.
Hillary Faye's gonna freak out when I'm out there waiting for her.
Who cares?
It's just that I don't get out much on my own.
I'm not really a stripper, you know.
I'm not really a Christian. So, how'd you end up at American Eagle? I mean, you're Jewish, right?
Well, after I got expelled from my last school, it was either here or homeschooling. I figure I could handle these freaks better than my parents.
Well, lucky me.
Are you playing footsies with me?
Wheelies.
Hey, isn't that...
Mary? What is she doing downtown?
Well, there's only one reason Christian girls come down to the Planned Parenthood.
She's planning a pipe bomb?
Okay, two reasons.
When the film was released in 2004, Terry asked Macaulay Culkin why he wanted to be part of the film Saved.
I mean, it was just such a smart movie. It was just so smart and funny, and I just loved how it approached issues, and I loved just the structure of it. I love the fact that it kind of, you know, all these characters start off as these kind of, you know, almost cliches or caricatures almost of teen movies or of Christianity even. I love how they kind of break down or are torn down throughout the course of the film, and it kind of exposed for what they really are. And I just love the subject matter. I mean, I'm not a very, very religious person, but at the same time, I was one of those people who was, I was raised Catholic, which means I'm an ex-Catholic. But, you know, went to Catholic school, you know, math, English, Jesus Christ. It's kind of a part of the curriculum. And so, you know, which is something that's, you know, I've always found interesting. So, yeah, I just wanted to be a part of it.
What did you relate to about the character that you play in Saved?
Well, I love, you know, he was very cynical. Because he, you know, he's in a wheelchair in the movie, and his older sister, or actually younger sister, Hillary Faye, played by Mandy Moore, is always kind of wheeling him around like he's some sort of merit badge. Like, you know, look how good of a Christian I am. I take care of my brother who's in a wheelchair. And it kind of exposes him to the manipulative aspects of religion, of Christianity. And so he rejects it, basically. And I think by the end, he kind of comes full circle, and he eventually kind of ends up finding how he's right with Jesus, basically, and finding his religion.
Well, I have to say, I think you've made such really interesting and, in a way, daring choices in the movies that you've decided to make as an adult.
Thank you.
You know, you took like a hiatus of, I don't know, 8 or 9 years away from acting.
Something like that, yeah.
Then you did a play on the West End in London,
mm-hmm.
and then your reemergence in movies was Party Monster, in which you played a gay, drug-addicted club kid who becomes so addled he murders his drug dealer. Let me play a short clip from the movie, and this comes from early in the film when you're doing a voiceover narration telling the viewers about the story of your life. And your narration intersects a little bit with your mother's description of your childhood.
Hi, I'm Michael. I grew up in the Midwest. Usual story, felt different, really didn't fit in. But I wasn't going to turn the other cheek. No siree. I started selling candy in school. Jacked up the prices several 100%.
This is my Michael. He was always making money. He had a knack for it.
Yeah.
My little candy man.
Let's see. What else? Oh. Once when I was 10, my Sunday school teacher took me back to his house. He taught me how to French kiss, among other things.
He really took my boy under his wing. Very nice man.
His mother caught us in the basement, and she screamed, "I told you not to bring them here." And he said, "Don't, you'll frighten them away."
One night, Michael gave me a goodnight kiss that a little boy should not give his mother.
I thought everyone kissed like that.
No, you look and sound so different in this movie than, say, in your child movie era. I'm interested in that kind of voice that you got for the film.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, because we were playing real people. We kind of really tried to stay true to who they were. I mean, there's kind of certain rules that apply to playing a character like that, because you want to try your best to talk like them. You want to try your best to move like them and things like that. And these people were very, very specific about the way they talked and the way that they just kind of move their arms and things. And so we kind of had to play within those rules, basically. But, yeah, me and Seth just went out there. And I remember when he first signed on to it, because we kind of talked about doing this and we kind of had a plan about how we're going to prepare and how we're going to just do all these things. And
this is Seth Green, you're a co-star.
Seth Green, my co-star. And so, yeah, he calls me up on the phone. He goes, hi, you know, hi, Michael, it's James. You know, I was in New York, but I'm sorry I missed you. And blah, 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 blah. You know, he kind of just leaves you this message in like a dead-on James St. James impression. I couldn't believe it. Actually, I listened to it on the phone and replayed the tape, and I couldn't believe it. And I was like, gosh, I got to get on my game, too. So I started kind of messing around with the voice and basically playing repeat-after-me games with the VCR and, you know, any kind of footage I can get of him. And went to a voice person to kind of just literally kind of almost phonetically write out some of the stuff. But, you know, just talk like Michael, you know. Oh, James, and I called him up. I'm like, James, I'm sorry I missed you when you were in town. You crazy, you know, just like sending all these weird, you know, like voice messages to each other. It was fun, you know. And we really just wanted, like I said, we wanted to talk like them and move like them as much as possible, but at the same time, not make caricatures of them. And at the same time, you wanted enough creative freedom within the characters to maneuver and do kind of whatever you felt was appropriate for storytelling. So it's a fine line you tread, but I think we pulled it off all right.
One of the things I found really interesting about your portrayal of Michael Alec in Party Monster is that in one respect, he's the opposite of you. And here's what I mean. You become a star at the age of, what, 8 or something? 10?
Yeah, basically.
You know, in Home Alone. And by the time you were 14, you wanted out of that whole star-making machinery stuff. You wanted to stop acting and you wanted out of show business, at least for a while. And whereas he comes to New York and he wants to be a star. I mean, he is living to be famous. He is living to be seen.
No, he spent his entire life running towards fame. I spent half my life running away from it.
Well, as someone who was a star as a child and who wanted to leave that whole thing, did you understand what being famous, what being a star would mean to somebody like Michael Alec? Did you understand what it meant to be desperate or why somebody would want it?
It's interesting because I truly don't understand fame. I kind of just accept it. You know, I've been doing this since I was 4 years old, and it's just, you know, it's 19 years now, and you know, for a while there, you know, from when I was about 8 years old on, I was playing the game at a pretty high level overall. And so I don't know. It wasn't like I was consciously saying to myself, ah, gosh, I want to be famous. You know, it was just kind of like I had a lot of energy and I enjoyed the attention that came with being on stage. And it wasn't about the attention that came, not all the other attention, like, you know, photographers hiding in your bushes. You know, I could definitely do without that and could have done even when I was 8 years old without that. Like I said, fame had nothing to do with it with me. So it was kind of fun to get in there and kind of just, you know, why would he want that? Where does this come from? You know, it was coming from this kind of, this almost need to fit in almost. And he kind of took it to this hyper reality, basically, and created his own world where he was famous, you know. And because in that world, you have to understand, back in the club days, back in, like, you know, after Andy Warhol basically passed on, the club scene was basically dead. Before, you go to these clubs and like, oh, look, there's Liza Minnelli. Oh, look over there, there's Cher, you know, and that was kind of the way it was. But now they were all gone. All these kind of club idols were gone. And so Michael kind of swept in and created these celebrities, basically. Basically just said, I'm famous because I say so. And I have absolutely no substance to me whatsoever, but that doesn't matter because I'm famous. And it's just this weird concept that, you know, the celebrity without a cause kind of thing, you know. It's just like, you know, famous because I say so. And you have to understand that all these people were coming from this world, like this high school world, basically, where, you know, insiders and outsiders, and they were definitely the outsiders. They were homosexuals. They didn't dress right. They didn't look right. There was a lot of things wrong with them. And so then now they come to New York City and they're the kings of the clubs. Now all the people, all those like people who played high school football and all those people who were really cool in high school were now standing outside of their clubs wanting to get into their world. And they were kind of turned the tables in the entire world and said, you know what? No, you're not. not in. You're not allowed into our little world. And it was interesting. It was kind of more coming from that than almost a need to be like, you know, famous and on the cover of magazines. It was more kind of just turning the tables on the entire world.
Macaulay Culkin speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with actor and now author Macaulay Culkin. His first book, Junior, was published earlier this month.
What are some of the differences for you between acting as a child and acting now as an adult?
It was interesting. I mean, when I was younger, it was just more about, I had a lot of energy, and like I said, I enjoyed attention, or at least the good kind of attention that came with being on stage. And that was really all it came from. And they kind of, a lot of the things I did when I was younger was literally just kind of when you're a child actor, the most important thing is you have to know your lines. It's amazing. Like, that's all they really care about when they're casting a kid, is know your lines. And so my father, you know, for everything that he was still a very clever man. And so one of the things he did for the audition process was, they'd send me the script, and they'd say, oh, do scene 22 and scene 12 or whatever. And they're very, very short, simple scenes. So what he'd do is he'd go through the entire script and find the two longest speeches and the two longest, hardest scenes and have me memorize. Because I had a pretty good memory, and I remembered the whole thing. And so when I got into the room, me being a cute little 9-year-old, they say, hey, can you do scene 12? And I go, oh, wait, but I studied scene 30, you know? And they'll go, oh, it's okay, little kid, just do what you studied. And then I go out and I reel off this long thing, and the next thing I know, I have the part, you know? And so it was, like I said, it was more about having a lot of energy and learning your lines, basically. Whereas now it's different, you know? It's you definitely can't just do that, you know? And so, no, I mean, I try to bring more to my work. I mean, I'm definitely a more experienced human being, and so I just try to bring those kind of things to the table and just try to, you know.
And you get to choose. You get to choose your roles now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, after a while, I mean, I wasn't choosing anything. It was just kind of like, oh, by the way, don't make any plans this summer because you're doing a movie and things like that. So now I'm in a position where I'm making my own choices. I'm putting stuff out there that I want out there, that, you know, and so it's cool. And so I just try to do different kinds of things. And, you know, I just try to do good work. That's all.
You know, it's so easy, I think, to become a praise junkie when you're a kid, you know, if people are praising you a lot.
Yeah, I really wasn't so much. I wasn't, you know, my parents were pretty good overall. Like, they never told me how much money I was making or things like that. All that stuff kind of was news to me. When I turned 18, I found out how much money I'd made. And
weren't you reading the newspapers? I mean, I knew how much money you were making.
Yeah, but you know what? No one does. That's the thing. People still don't. You should hear the kinds of numbers people throw out. I mean, they're either way too high or way too low.
Oh,
I don't
okay.
know. There's all kinds of numbers being thrown out there. I don't release my financial records. It's not something that's all that important. I mean, yes, it's important. I'm definitely glad I have the money, but at the same time, it's not like something I don't release my numbers to Forbes magazine or something like that. But yeah, no, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like I was doing it for even the gratification. I was just having a blast. I enjoyed the people on set. You know, I liked working with Chris Columbus. I love the stunt people. They were always my favorite, you know, like I had a good time on set. And so
when did that
really
start to change? When did the good time start to not be?
You know what? I always liked the people on set. I always liked the hair and makeup people. I always liked the wardrobe. They were always really cool people, and they always really got it. They understood the position that I was in, really. And so, it wasn't even that. It was just kind of like I needed a break. And I remember I said this to my father, and he kind of just wasn't listening. The next thing I know, I'm on the next set. And then I started kind of telling anyone who'd listen. But, you know, obviously I was wrong because no one was listening. And it was kind of this crazy thing. And so when my father was out of the picture and I was in a position to say, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, I did. And so I went to whoever was listening or whoever was out there and just said, listen, you can call it retirement. You can call it a break. You can say I quit. It doesn't really matter because it's yours now. It's not mine. You guys can, you know, that Macaulay Culkin public persona is yours. You can do whatever you want with it. I'm going to go to high school, and I'm going to do whatever else from there. But I'm probably never going to act again, and that's it. You know, I hope you made your money because there's no more coming from me.
When you were young and getting paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars for movie roles, did you have a sense of what was riding on you financially, not just your family, but like the director's future, the movie company's future, you know, and all the people working for them? I mean, the movie had to be a success. Your name had to really
hold
up.
I know. There was this weird kind of thing. People were kind of building this odd industry around me, and it was kind of this weird thing. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess they tried their best to shelter me from a lot of that stuff, but at the same time, you can't really hide from that, you know, just the overall pressures of it. But it wasn't anything that, like, made me crack or, you know, shattered me emotionally or something. It was just kind of, it was at a point where I almost didn't know any better. You know, I mean, I understood that other 9-year-olds weren't doing the same things I was, but at the same time, it wasn't like I knew what Little League was like, you know, or what summer camp was like. I mean, this was my life, and so I didn't really know anything else. So, you know, I mean, part of it was, like, a little too much, and that was one of the things why I got away. But it wasn't something I was consciously saying to myself, you know, like, oh, gosh, you know, I really hope we make that, you know, we make that $50 million so the studio will hire me for their next movie. Because at that point, I really didn't care.
You said that your father really pushed you. What are some of the things you think he did wrong in terms of how hard he pushed you or what he pushed you to do?
It's funny. You know, it's one of these things where, I don't know, I mean, people kind of have this weird, you know, this weird thing about me and my father, at least our relationship. They're always kind of like, oh, you know, isn't that sad that, you know, you don't really see your father anymore or anything like that. And it's like, you know, and that everything turned out the way that it did. But what people don't understand was that it was always like this, that, like, you know, he was not a good guy long before we were rich and famous. It was kind of just a part of his personality. And from a very early age, I pretty much knew that, you know, I was, you know, either he was going to be gone or I was going to end up moving out of the house very early. It was one or the other. And I knew that from a very early age, before fame, before money, before anything. And so
what was it that he did that made you realize
he just
that?
Honestly, I wish it was that easy. I wish it was I could point out to one incident or one thing and say that was it. I mean, he was just not a good person. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to understand. I mean, later on, I mean, it was like, you know, I was making who knows how much money, and I was sleeping on the couch in the living room. Like, I didn't even have a bed. I didn't have a room or a bed. I mean, you should have saw his room, and you should have saw the size of his bed and his television and things like that. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't about making me, you know. You know, it was kind of more just putting you in your place and making sure that you knew who was in charge of the whole thing. And it's kind of like, and he played those games with you, and he was always playing those games with you. And so, you know, like, you know, even from a very early age, I knew what kind of person he was. And I knew, you know, I watched him very closely. I wanted to make sure how I wasn't with my children and how I did not want to treat my wife and things like that. I mean, I knew that from a very early age. I mean, I remember he was the first person I ever cussed at, ever. I was like 4 years old, and, you know, I forgot what he was doing or what I was doing. But, yeah, I told him to F off. I couldn't believe it, you know, like, wow. I didn't even believe it then. I was like, wow, I was like 3 or 4 years old, and that came out of my mouth. It was just like, but that was our relationship. That was the way it was.
You know, there's so many child stars who just are emotional cripples by the time they reach adulthood. You seem to have, like, emerged okay.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, I understand that I'm a part of, like, some weird fraternity and some weird kind of convention or you know, group of cliches or whatever. And, you know, I understand that. But at the same time, I don't, you know, I'm aware of it, but I don't fight it.
Are you really okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. No, man, I feel good. I think, you know, and a lot of that had to do with me taking some time off and me getting away from everything, you know. And just, I feel like I'm a strong person because of it. I know what I want out of life. And I'm not kind of just doing this because I don't know any better. I mean, I see a lot of, you know, not a lot, but, there's a good amount of these child actors or former child actors who trying to make that transition into adulthood, but never really took the time to live. It never really took the time to exist. And so how do you expect someone to act like a human being when they've never had the chance to be a human being?
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Macaulay Culkin, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His book is called Junior, or Oscar de la Mancha, The Wembling Warrior, and The People I Like the Least. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews a new foreign film. This is Fresh Air. L'Enfant, or The Child, was the winner of the Palme d'Or at last year's Cannes Film Festival. The directors are Belgian brothers Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardens, whose work includes Rosetta and The Sun. Our film critic, David Edelstein, has a review.
The handheld camera in the films of the Belgian brothers Jean-Pierre and Luc Dardens stays at eye level. You don't get those overhead panorama establishing shots. You get a perspective that's in sync with the emotions, or lack of them, in a lone protagonist. In the films Rosetta and The Sun, that protagonist is unreadable for a while and unlikable for much longer. But it's only in the new L'Enfant that the main character is actively loathsome. His name is Bruno, played by Jeremy Renier, and he lives virtually homeless in an industrial Belgian city, a broke and unemployed petty thief who routinely exploits young kids to do his dirty work. His single accomplishment seems to have been fathering a boy with his girlfriend, Sonia, played by Deborah Francois, an accomplishment he definitively negates by impulsively selling the newborn, without the doting mother's knowledge, to a ring of illegal adoption brokers. Before this, we've seen him through the eyes of Sonia, who loves Bruno and expects him to be there for the baby. But when she finds out what he did, she goes into the hospital in a borderline catatonic state, and so she drops out of the picture for a while, and we're stuck with the feckless loser, who lives in a fog with no larger awareness, stirred only by sex, tacky clothes, and booze. But Bruno is blindsided by Sonia's inconsolable grief. He knows, on some level, that what he did was beyond horrific. It was a primal act of betrayal. Maybe he did it because he couldn't face the idea of fatherhood and its responsibilities. Maybe, he senses, he'll have to live with the consequences forever. The Dardens don't write introspective monologues. Their dialogue is spare. And they don't resort to obvious expressionist techniques, splashy colors, or music. In fact, their work is distinguished by the absence of those things, sometimes to the point of sensory deprivation. But the senses you have left are heightened. In a medium of surfaces, like cinema, they plunge you as deeply into their characters' psyches as it's possible to go. As a larger consciousness wells up, Bruno slowly comes into focus, and his face, which had seemed so uninteresting and unreadable, draws you in. He wanders around, trying to process what he's done. And as he discovers that the road to redemption is more arduous than any he has traveled, you feel as if you're watching the movement of a soul. His final act, which has nothing to do with his own child, is psychologically and poetically right. And it's here that you realize that the baby of the title is not just his and Sonia's. It's also the boy's that he exploits in his thefts. Most importantly, it's Bruno himself. L'Enfant is the Dardens' most accessible film, and the one most likely to find a large audience in the United States. It's exhausting and overwhelming. After all, when you introduce a helpless infant into a drama, the stakes go rocketing. All the same, the movie strikes me as less morally complex and original and unpredictable than their last film, The Sun, which is a deeply Christian parable about a carpenter who hires the paroled killer of his only child as an apprentice. The moral stakes here are much more clear-cut. Selling one's child? Bad. Hiring kids to rob people? Bad. Learning the meaning of sacrifice? Good. No. Holy. That said, I can't recommend L'Enfant enough, because it's rare to see an eye-level camera that can turn so miraculously inward.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Now it's time to mark your calendars. A week from Monday, we'll feature Terry's interview with Ray Davies of The Kinks. He's just released his first solo recording. Here's a track from it. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Mr. Jones, my next door neighbor, I feel I've known you all my life. I haven't seen you for a while now. How's the family? How's that beautiful wife? I hope your dreams were not forgotten and you've become downtrodden. Get your health together. Get your wealth together. Get yourself together, Jones. You are my next door neighbor. Mr. Brown, you're so ambitious. You ran off with an Essex blonde. You broke the bank to keep two women. You're overextended, now it's all gone wrong. Now you're right back where you started. Still, you shouldn't be broken-hearted. Get your mind together. We can still climb together. A step at a time together.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Into the Blue, a novel of psychological suspense set in Britain by Robert Goddard. From the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, veteran actor Seymour Cassell joins us to talk about his roles in the new TV series Heist and in the movie Lonesome Jim. Cassell has been acting in film and television since the early 60s. His early career was linked with director John Cassavetes. Join us for the next Fresh Air.